From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. State tourism officials say it's been a challenging summer for the state's number two industry. They're starting work on the annual economic impact analysis that's typically released in January, and they call initial data a mixed bag. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Weather, construction at Mount Rushmore, and troubles with wind and Jewel Cave elevators all put a damper on attendance to the state's iconic attractions, West River. However, hotel occupancy across the entire state remained above the national average. That's according to the Secretary of the Department of Tourism, Jim Hagan, who says initial tourism tax and revenue numbers show some growth. Hagan says visitation to the state is, quote, to be determined. He says he can't recall the state having weather like this before.
You know, when you're looking at a state that is dealing with four, five, or six presidential disaster declarations, that's a lot. You look at the impact that that has had on our farm and ranch families. You know, South Dakota having the most acreage that went unplanted this year because of all of the rain and all of the flooding. That's significant, and that impacts the tourism industry. We need our farm and ranch families, not only in South Dakota, but in our target markets, to be doing well, and it's been a struggle.
Hagan says airport arrivals are up 10.5%, and visitor spending looks like it's slightly up. Data on tourism tax collections lags by about 2 months. Official data is expected during the governor's conference on tourism in January.
Education majors at Augustana University have the opportunity to experience cutting-edge classroom tools through makerspace workshops. Robots, iPads, and circuit boards help students of any level engage with a variety of subjects in a way that feels like play. SDPB's Jackie Hendry reports.
The three makerspace workshops this semester are financed with the Oliver Innovation Fund through Augustana to encourage creativity throughout the university. Associate Professor of Education Michelle Powers applied for the grant to help future teachers learn to incorporate makerspace in their classrooms.
Makerspace is a concept that schools are employing to help students learn how to solve problems, basically, with both everyday tools and technology tools. It's also a way to explore learning concepts like robotics and coding.
College students have plenty of time to play with the makerspace items themselves. This workshop includes about half a dozen items, including magnetic geometric shapes for building, a set of wires connected to a computer to make a piano out of a bunch of bananas. Even a remote control robot to maneuver around the classroom. The unique items encourage collaboration and creative play. And Michelle Powers says even education faculty at Augustana are learning from the makerspace workshops.
But what I think is really important is districts are investing in these tools for a very important purpose, which is to help students become better problem solvers, deeper thinkers. It's very collaborative, and that's where we want to go with our students as well.
Each workshop also includes a talk from a makerspace expert in the Sioux Falls or T school districts.
Education and healthcare reporting on SDPB is supported by Regional Health, helping patients and communities live well.
A second tribe in South Dakota has adopted hate crime protections for LGBT people. The Crow Creek tribe met with proponents of the amendment and passed it unanimously. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
Marlo Medicine Crow Jr. is on the Crow Creek Tribe Law and Order Committee. He says the hate crimes amendment is the first of its kind for the tribe.
It was a long time coming. There's a lot of things that go on that maybe would necessitate that law and maybe help give more protections to them, to people that are being discriminated against.
Some federal hate crimes legislation applies to tribes, but adding codes to their own books helps ensure repercussions for offenders by adding on a $1,000 fine and increased jail time. The amendment Crow Creek adopted is modeled after the Matthew Shepherds Act.
Nobody wants their kids or families to be picked on, you know, and we're kind of a small community. And there's a need out there. The community usually comes together.
Two proponents spent months working to pass the amendment in the Oglala Lakota tribe this year. Monique or Muffy Musso was pleased with how quickly the Crow Creek tribe got on board.
Well, we was pretty happy because we got to meet Marlo's mom, and she's the one that actually looked at us and said, "We've been waiting for you girls to get here." So it was a pretty spiritual, amazing cultural thing.
Musso's wife, Philippa DeLeon, is also a proponent.
To hear the acceptance and to have them approve it unanimously, it was an awesome feeling to know that, you know, there is that protection for the LGBT community now.
The hate crime amendment is expected to take effect for the Crow Creek tribe next month.
November is a month for thanks and giving. In the Moment has been spending the month taking an in-depth look at gratitude and philanthropy in South Dakota. We're asking questions like, can practicing gratitude make you happier, healthier, and more connected? What's the role of altruism in the state, and how do South Dakotans maximize the value of their generosity? We're spending November thankful, inspired, and determined to make a difference right here at home, culminating in South Dakota's Day of Giving. So why do we give, and what's the economic impact of giving? In the Moment, host Lori Walsh welcomed Mike Algren, PhD. He's a professor of economics at the University of South Dakota, to answer this question.
Dr. Algren, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk. This is kind of a fascinating topic to dig into as an economist. It's probably not what you spend your everyday working on, so we appreciate you opening.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and economists usually talk about things that are a lot less interesting, so I appreciate the opportunity.
Perfect. All right, so what we're wondering is, you know, is it even measured? Are we interested in measuring the economics of giving in America?
Sure. There are lots of people who've been looking at this question, sort of broad picture. Last year, 2018, in the United States, we donated over $427 billion to charity, which is a substantial amount. Most of that's coming from individuals. About three-fourths of it is from individual families donating, and the remaining 25% coming from foundations and bequests. So I think that's interesting. We also can tell that the proportion of that, of course, comes from high individuals. They're going to be able to donate the most. But the proportion of income spent on charity by households in the United States is actually highest among both high-income households and low-income households. So you see both of those giving a large proportion of their income to charity.
Really? A low-income household will give money to charity?
That's correct. Which I find sort of interesting. These are households that often you would think as recipients of charity, but they're also among the highest to give.
And then what about those people in the middle?
Right. So I don't see a real strong explanation for that. So some ideas I think might be, they are giving more in total dollars as their income increases towards that middle income range. They're just not giving as high as a proportion, perhaps because they haven't been on the receiving end. They don't see it as much. Or it also could be that those households are giving more in terms of time, and that's not showing up in the dollar amounts. Obviously, when you get to the high levels, it makes a lot of sense to donate, both for tax reasons and probably for social reasons, that it makes sense that when you're someone who's been given a lot and been successful, that you feel, I think, some social pressure to give back.
Oh, interesting. So there's a sense of, we prepare for the South Dakota Day of Giving, you know, we think of it as excitement and kind of getting to know everybody in South Dakota who's, you know, doing good work to help people in a huge variety of ways. But there's also a tiny bit of, hey, pay attention. This is something you can do and maybe you should be doing. Nudge, nudge.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. I think absolutely that we're influenced by the behaviors of those around us. And it's one reason that it's probably good to publicize charitable giving, even if it feels like maybe that's not the most altruistic way to talk about. Maybe you want to keep your donations quiet, but letting people know that you donate maybe helps them see that that's something they could do too.
Right. Three-quarters given by individuals, where I would have thought it would have been largely foundation-based.
Right.
Because that kind of makes the news, too.
Sure.
Again,
and those are obviously big amounts, right?
Yeah. And foundations send press releases.
Sure.
You know, whereas individuals, you know, an individual family that writes even a very large check isn't necessarily going to, you know, send out a press release and saying this is what we've done for our local charity.
That's a great point.
Oh, all right. So why, you know, why do we do this? Because we don't have to. I mean, there are tax advantages, but why do we give?
Right. So I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that we're not just giving. Well, there's several reasons, right? So we might be giving for selfish reasons, that is, you know, tax advantages or something like that. I think a more likely reason that at least is somewhat self-interested, if not selfish, is that we like the way that it makes us feel. And I think that's a good thing. And there's pretty strong evidence that that's a substantial motivator in why people choose to give. And of course, just pure altruism is another option, right? We just want to help people. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having a mix of those things in your decision to donate. So we've some interesting reasons that might help you think about altruism versus your sort of warm glow feeling that you get from donating. You can imagine how you feel after an hour of donating your time. Say you work in a soup kitchen for an hour and it feels really good and you feel good that you helped out. You could have spent that hour working, right? You could have taken on an extra job or an extra project and made money, and perhaps you could have made enough money to hire 4 people to work in a soup kitchen for an hour. Right. Mm-hmm. And then that would be a larger impact in theory in sort of your charitable giving. But maybe that wouldn't feel quite as good to you personally, that you wouldn't develop that connection with those people that you're helping. And so your motivation isn't quite the same.
Right. So part of that theory is that if you, depending on what your job is,
right,
you might make more as an attorney than you would in food service, which is essentially what working at a soup kitchen might be. But yet, there's a reason to show up and ladle the soup.
Right, right. So, I mean, if it was purely altruism and you didn't care about how you made it made you feel and you just wanted to help the most people possible, given the amount of time you had, it might be better to just buy all that those services rather than donating your own. But I don't think that's what motivates most people.
Right.
I think they care about that, but I think they also care about the connection that they can make personally.
Right. It does make us feel good.
Right. With gifts too, so I mean, we're thinking mostly about charitable giving, but even in gifts to our family members or friends and things like that, when we give gifts, sometimes it's out of obligation, but hopefully a lot of times it's because we feel like we're going to help that person and that makes us feel good. Economists do have some sort of bad news about some of those things. Often economists say that, you know, cash is more efficient because the person can buy exactly what they want. But not too many people feel really a warm glow feeling from giving somebody else cash or receiving cash, right? The idea that the person knows you and knows enough about you to pick out a thoughtful gift is part of what makes it feel good.
Right. We care about that relationship, not just the transaction.
Absolutely.
How do we, if you know, some people get hung up on this idea that, you know, I want to give to a charity, but there's a lot of options, you know, with sort of, you know, crowdsourcing and, you know, GoFundMe pages. You see these things all the time, and sometimes you're even suspicious of, you know, what's coming your way. But let's talk about giving effectively. What are some of the parameters?
Sure. So thinking about the consequences of our giving rather than just the immediate feeling is a really good thing to do. So there are charities that sound very helpful and turn out not to be very helpful, and others that sound maybe not as interesting that are very effective. There's a good story from, this was in the late 1990s, there was an idea called the Play Pump, which was a children's merry-go-round that would also work as a water pump to help poor villages. Basically, you would provide these playground equipment, which was great, and also would pump water at the same time, and it was really exciting, and USAID got involved, and several foundations. The rapper Jay-Z was really involved with this, and it got a lot of press. But it turns out it wasn't very effective. The pump didn't work very well, either as a merry-go-round or as a pump. It turns out the people who were doing this, basically it didn't enhance the well-being in those villages very much at all. Versus, say, another thing that doesn't sound very exciting, which is deworming. So there are lots of intestinal parasites in third world countries that it turns out have been extremely effective, not just in improving the health of children and adults, but in improving educational outcomes, improving productivity at work, and raising incomes in the long run. But no one thinks, oh, I really want to donate money to deworming. It doesn't sound very exciting, but it turns out it's very effective.
I don't carry the tote bag around.
Right.
Dewormed, yeah, right?
Doesn't look quite as good, right? So there are lots of places you can go to look at most lives saved per dollar or most good done per dollar. GiveWell.org is one that I like a lot that kind of talks about some underfunded charities that also offer a really good return on your investment.
Yeah, keep it close to home or far away?
That's a great question. A lot of faraway countries do have a better return, sort of bang for your buck. That is buying, you know, mosquito netting, for example, to prevent malaria when people are sleeping. That has a huge return, but it's not anywhere near us here in South Dakota. So I think looking at it purely from a, you know, return per dollar may miss some of the importance of that feeling that you get from helping someone and being able to see the return of what you did. So if you're worried about both feeling good about your donation, but also doing a lot of good, you might want to sort of consider donating some far away and some locally. I think that local donation might help you feel what you need to feel to keep giving over time.
Do you have a sense if, you know, we hear anecdotally about, you know, charities suffering when the economy suffers, you know, more people are in need and fewer people are giving. And I'm just wondering about the big picture of it when, you know, with a $427 billion, you know, just in 2018, mm-hmm. what happens if people stop? What if it falls out of favor or people can't give or, you know, those numbers go down? There's a whole lot can happen to the U.S. economy without charitable giving.
Sure. You know, that's a really interesting. It's a really interesting question. I'm not aware of any data that shows giving patterns during recessions. Say, my guess is that we probably see a decrease, but maybe not as much as we think. I think as times are tough, people become more aware of the need to sort of band together and work together. And just like we saw, like a large portion of donations coming from low income households, I kind of think that during tough times, we might be more likely to remember those less fortunate.
And in times of crisis, too, disasters, tornadoes.
That's a great
hurricanes,
point.
Hurricanes, floods, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, those actually are really good at encouraging people to give. In fact, they're much more likely to give, someone's more likely to give after a disaster or something immediate that shows an immediate need than they are, say, to very compelling but long-term needs, like, say, malaria prevention, which is costs many more lives per year than, say, earthquakes or hurricanes, but the earthquake or hurricane definitely seems more immediate. One thing you might do is when you're feeling those, you know, you have those emotions that come from a wildfire or whatever it might be, and think about the money you could donate, but maybe take a day and think about where's the best place I can send this money, and some of it might go to that disaster and some might go to more long-standing issues.
Yeah. Are there ways, you know, so much about, you know, studying economics is really about understanding human behavior, it seems to me. This is just part of what makes us human, is the desire to help one another. When we're in need, isn't it? I mean, it has to. And when you study, you know, economic theory and history and different economies throughout history, it has to be something that's woven into it in these really interesting ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. We're not just you know, calculators of trying to maximize our own personal benefit. Other people's utility, as we would say in economics, is part of our utility. We get satisfaction when we know that those around us are doing well too.
Breast cancer survivors who've undergone mastectomies have a new crafty option in artificial breasts. A local yarn store in Rapid City is helping fill the need through a national program called Knitted Knockers. Volunteers craft breasts and give them to survivors. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
There are buckets of expertly stitched breasts lying around the Slipknits yarn store. They come in different shades of nude, fun shades of purple and pink, and even special yarns for swimming. Kim Osland is the owner.
It is a program where knitters and crocheters knit or crochet with approved yarns, boobs for ladies who need them.
Donors supply yarn that's gentle on skin and scars. After the breast shape is made, it's filled with a silky stuffing. Osland says any survivor who wants these can pick them up for free at different locations in Rapid City.
We have them at Dr. Raymond's office, and we have them available in our store. They're also at the Cancer Care Center, and we're working on getting them into any places that would like to have them to get to women who need them. That's the whole goal.
Osland says the goal is to make 500 pairs in a year. And they're halfway there. She says this project is important to the volunteer crafters.
My mom died of breast cancer. Many women around our table have had breast cancer, had sisters, moms, husbands. It's everywhere, so we're all affected.
The breasts come in any size. Jo Ben helps knit and organize knitted knockers.
They're adjustable. Women, when they get them, can add or subtract stuffing or push it around to make it fit them personally.
Ben says this is a great option for women who don't like the feel of breast prostheses.
A community resource center in Vermilion is launching a new program in partnership with the University of South Dakota. The United Way of Vermilion and members from the USD Master of Public Health Program created the Community Navigator Program in efforts to support local families and individuals. SDPB's John Wynn reports.
Okay, Mary, I'm going to balance.
Two volunteers are moving stacks of boxes by the back doors of a building.
You're pushing off. Cool.
The boxes are full of bread donated by local grocery stores. One man finishes loading the last box onto a cart destined to line the shelf of the food pantry down the hall. The pantry is just one of many services housed under the Community Connection Center in downtown Vermilion. Members of the United Way of Vermilion created the center to house several resources under one roof. Kelsey Collier-Wise is the executive director of the organization. She says the center coordinates different resources to provide for the local community.
It's really a one-stop for a number of social services, including the food pantry and the welcome table, backpack program, diaper bank, a bunch of different services all in one place. And one of the things that we hope to do in this space is to really address poverty and need in our community holistically and not just address one need at a time or work in a silo, but really look at the whole person and what all of their needs are.
To reach their goals, the United Way of Vermilion partnered with the University of South Dakota to enlist the help of a community navigator. They are tasked to work with people in need to connect them with resources. Collier-Wise says the idea originated with members from a public health program at USD. She and others developed the community navigator position and chose a first-year USD graduate student to take on the role, Viviana De Leon. De Leon hails from Sioux City, Iowa, where she worked as a part-time financial counselor in a community health center after earning her undergraduate degree this year. She says her experience led her to say yes to the job.
It just kind of reminded me of like the kind of work that I did at the community health center that I worked at. So I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to show my skills in a meaningful process.
De Leon began in early September and since then has been shaping the pilot program, generating awareness for the community to know that many resources are out there. She says she has a lot to set up as the first navigator, but like the food pantry volunteers at the center, she's moving one box at a time.
Wednesday marked the first day of public hearings for the impeachment inquiry regarding President Donald Trump. South Dakota Public Broadcasting has been airing the public hearings live on SDPB Radio and SDPB TV. NPR has brought you coverage and analysis, but on Thursday, In the Moment brought listeners to SDSU poli-sci professors to help give us a better understanding of what we learned Wednesday. Lisa Hager, an assistant professor of political science at South Dakota State University, and David Wiltsey, an associate professor of political science at South Dakota State University. Here's that interview with In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
All right, well, there's a lot to unpack here. And, you know, people have been unpacking it on NPR for quite some time, but I'm also curious if South Dakota listeners have questions they would like to ask the professors here. They can email us inthemoment@sdpb.org, and we'll see if we can get some of their perspective. Dr. Hager, let's start with you. Give us some idea of some of the key moments that you thought from yesterday's hearings that stood out.
Mm-hmm. I think really kind of the big takeaway was the fact that Bill Taylor really revealed that one of his staffers did overhear a phone call between the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, and then President Trump the day after the call that we heard about between Trump and the Ukrainian president. And so, you know, there the staffer, you know, mentioned that, you know, that they had felt like they had heard that there was some evidence of some sort of quid pro quo relationship that was occurring between Ukraine launching investigations and the United States releasing that aid.
And why did this information just, you know, why was that news made yesterday?
This is really like the first opportunity for anyone to really hear publicly what has been getting said. And so, you know, it's possible that maybe some of this information had been disclosed in the closed door hearings and what have you. But this is really kind of the first opportunity that we did get to hear that publicly.
Right. And why is it significant in the sense that they say that President Donald Trump's response in that conversation, which was overheard, which was loud enough to be overheard by the State Department staffer, was that the president cared more about the investigation of Joe Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for, is the quotation mm-hmm. that I have in mm-hmm. front of me. That seems like a pretty significant detail.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, it definitely is significant. I think kind of the one caveat with some of this is just the fact that they weren't able to necessarily report per se specifically that that it was exactly being put across as really a quid pro quo exchange. It was more that, like, it was clear that there would be a stalemate with the funding if there wasn't an investigation launched. And so obviously, like, there's some assumptions that can be made there and some takeaways that, you know, both parties are going to have from that comment. You know, the Democrats are really going to see that sort of conversation and comment meaning exactly what they were saying all along, was that there was this quid pro quo exchange, where Republicans are saying, well, that's just really kind of their interpretation of that particular conversation. That doesn't necessarily mean that what was the takeaway, because it is something that's just being overheard.
Right.
I would add,
go ahead. Yeah.
Another really important thing besides the content of the call was the fact that this call was made in the first instance on a cell phone in a semi-public place, where the EU ambassador was having a conversation with the president directly, mm-hmm. Which is just a huge breach of security protocols that we normally have in these kinds of conversations. So it just highlights how this entire operation on the side, outside of the normal diplomatic channels, really was a serious breach of the norms in how we go about conducting foreign policy.
So according to NPR, multiple congressional sources have identified David Holmes as the aide, and he is scheduled to testify in a closed-door session on Friday. Unclear whether he'll testify in open session. Can either of you explain to me, like, when those decisions are being made about closed-door versus open-door in this process?
Mm-hmm. So for the most part, the congressional investigation into the possible impeachment has really just been put together through the resolution that was passed, really kind of launching the investigation formally. And so that kind of just outlines what this impeachment inquiry will actually look like. So obviously, up until this point, the closed door impeachment inquiry procedures are really criticized because that resolution hadn't actually been approved yet by the House. Obviously, even once the resolution did go through, they were attacked for still putting through the resolution and going forward with the inquiry and things like that. Basically, it's just giving Congress the opportunity to kind of lay out how they're actually going about this. So we know that the House Intelligence Committee will be conducting public hearings and then writing a report setting forth its findings and any recommendations that can then go to the House Judiciary Committee and eventually be made public. And so at this point, it's really just the House kind of deciding when they want to have things be private and when they want things to be public.
And what about this notion of hearsay, that there's a lot of things that are being overheard and then reported? Republicans are criticizing Democrats heavily for this. Any teeth to that criticism that, you know, when you compare it to what most of us understand about what happens in a court of law, hearsay is not even admissible, at least on TV.
Yeah. And I think like that's the thing here, is that we have to remember that this is a political proceeding and not a legal proceeding. And I think some of that has been conflated at times when the impeachment inquiry has been getting talked about. And so this is still very much political. So when there are charges of hearsay, it, you know, is just the nature of politics, unfortunately, at this point. And so I think really we just need to wait for all of the information to come out and to see really how the House moves forward with this. You know, if this is kind of all of the information that we ever get and the Democrats in the House choose to go forward with articles of impeachment and pass them, then everything will go over to the Senate, and then we'll kind of see what happens from there.
And in this particular instance, it's not hearsay to say that you overheard a conversation with somebody else. I'm sitting here listening to you and Lisa discuss something. That's something I'm hearing directly. So it's not technically hearsay in this particular instance. And, you know, the Democrats are being very careful about who they're bringing into the committee and who they're having testifying. I mean, we can be fairly certain that they are not going to be bringing witnesses in to answer questions that they already haven't corroborated with other witnesses. So we will hear from people in, you know, in meetings to come that will be able to corroborate most of what they're bringing in. Otherwise, they wouldn't have proceeded this far. So far, they're being very careful about this, and Adam Schiff is a former prosecutor. He knows how to put this kind of case together and how you slowly aggregate all this information into a solid case that reaches some threshold of evidence.
Right. And yet they're trying to do so on a fairly tight timeline, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, are there things that stood out to you? And Dr. Wiltsie, we can start with you, that of the accusations made against the president are sort of making the strongest grounds for articles of impeachment. What stands out as the strengths of the Democrats' arguments?
Mm-hmm. Well, so far, I think the most important things we learned yesterday was most of the facts that were brought out through the whistleblower inquiry are being slowly corroborated by these two witnesses, by these two folks who were in at various points of this conversation and certainly affected by the consequences of this conversation. I mean, we learned that, yes, this military and security aid was clearly delayed, conditioned on the investigation of the Bidens, that the Three Amigos and Giuliani had no interest in broader probes of Ukrainian corruption beyond what was relevant to the Biden investigation, and that there was this very clear breach of norms going outside of normal diplomatic channels and the decision-making apparatus that we have put in place to carefully vet and prepare policy and policy decisions for the president to make. Mm.
Professor Hager, anything you want to add to that as far as the what you feel the strongest arguments were from yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, I would really tend to agree with my colleague when it comes to just the fact that we're finally hearing these two witnesses really, you know, say this is in fact what we hear, and just kind of like confirm what has actually been set up until this point in a public forum.
Yeah. Does this get at the idea of the argument about whether or not they should reveal the name of the whistleblower or the whistleblower should come forward? David, are you getting at that when you say, you know, these things are these people who are coming forward publicly and putting their names and faces, you know, in front of the cameras, they're corroborating that complaint. Is it less relevant that we hear from the whistleblower or more relevant at this point?
I think a lot less relevant. You know, we have these whistleblower protections for a reason. And if you think back to Watergate, there were a number of informants, whistleblowers, etc., who we didn't learn their identities until decades after the Watergate scandal. I mean, we did not know that Mark Felt, the deputy FBI director, was Deep Throat until well after Richard Nixon had died and felt was in his last days here, at last few years of his life. So we really don't need to have this person come in when we can verify and confirm almost everything that he or she has heard and brought forward in that complaint.
We do have a listener question here, and it is, President Clinton was impeached, but he did not leave office. So if President Trump is impeached, what will that really mean in terms of his service in public office?
Well, he didn't leave office because he wasn't removed by the Senate. Is the listener's question more along the lines of if he's voted out by the Senate and not leave?
I think what we're getting at here is let's spin forward and make some assumptions that the House does file mm-hmm. articles of impeachment. It goes to the Senate, and the Senate says, yeah, there's problems here. What is that procedure like in the Senate? Because does that mean we're not talking about a president necessarily leaving office at this point because we have
right.
precedent for it to not happen.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we've had two impeachments in the House where they have voted on and approved articles of impeachment, and the Senate has not confirmed. But in both those cases, both President Johnson and President Clinton have had this asterisk next to their name. And this really is a stain on a person's legacy. So there are serious consequences in terms of the historical esteem that will be held for President Trump. I mean, this does hurt him long term, just as it's hurt Bill Clinton.
And as I heard on NPR last night, this is the first time that this has happened this close to an election cycle. Do I understand that correctly? Where not only are we talking about his public service, but, you know, we are coming up on an election.
Certainly in the case of Clinton, it was prior to it happened right during the midterm elections. I'm not so sure when Johnson's was.
Okay.
But that, yeah, that was a different era.
Yeah.
Elections were different.
Right.
So it's not not the same context.
Right. So he could be impeached and he could still, stay out his term. And Nixon
resigned.
Yes, absolutely.
And be reelected.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about that public opinion then, because mm-hmm. when we were looking at the support that he may or may not have in the Senate, it's early with these public hearings, but the American people are the ones that are also the audience here, the jurors here in some ways, because of how they respond to that. Talk about that a little
right.
bit, if you will.
Well, senators are certainly going to be taking cues from their electorates. Speaking of Republican senators here.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, both Republican senators and Republicans in the electorate, they're going to be waiting for some very clear evidence of a serious violation of public trust here before they are willing to go out on a limb and work against their party's interests in the upcoming election. And because we are so close to the election, this is probably going to make both senators and just average everyday voters, Republican voters, more resistant to moving forward against the president because we are, within a year of the election now. And that would be a serious handicap to the party if the president were to be removed shortly before an election like this in the middle of the primary process.
Mm-hmm. What about for people who are fans of Vice President Mike Pence, who feel like, is there any sense that Donald Trump could be seen as a liability, Mike Pence could be seen as a real strength for the party, and that if one goes, that you run into those fall 2020 elections with a really strong candidate?
I don't foresee a circumstance. Yeah. Well, I don't see a circumstance where the vice president could come out any better for this.
Mm.
So far his name has come up a few times that he has been, somewhat aware of what's going on, but certainly not in the mix of things. But, scandal has a habit of taking down a lot more people than just the individuals that are involved. And him, just by dint of being vice president, would certainly be harmed by this.
What about for Democrats? Because if this goes into the Senate, there are, I think, 5-6 you know, senators who would not be on the campaign trail in Iowa if they were sitting, you know, in impeachment hearings, and they're required to be there. How does it affect the Democrats going into primary season?
Well, for the few Democratic candidates, that would be that would hamper their electoral efforts on the campaign trail. But I would think most of them would take this as an opportunity to be center stage and to get a lot of visibility in the impeachment process itself. Mm-hmm. It's not as good as being in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and the other early states, but it is a pretty good substitute, I would imagine.
What are we looking to Friday and next week? And let's talk a little bit about the tone as well, because the tone was fairly by and large, with a little bit of sarcasm sprinkled in. It was what you would expect from congressional hearings, measured, stately, a little boring.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're all hoping for. You know, those of us who remember the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, like we're trying to avoid a major emotional spectacle, aren't we?
Right. And, you know, this expectation of politics being theater and having a kind of a theater critic approach to these hearings is it's not doing a service to the process. It's not doing a service to the country or democracy, really. I mean, this should be boring. We shouldn't expect fireworks. This is serious business. And the details of this are not going to be exciting.
Well, and thus far, what we've seen from both Taylor and Kent is their unwillingness to really engage in any sort of questions that would mm-hmm. make the process have more drama and fireworks. So when they were asked questions relating to whether they believe that the president had engaged in an impeachable offense, they really threw that question back at the committee and said, you know, that's really something for you to determine, not for us. And so I think going forward, we'll probably see similar behavior from witnesses.
Yeah, Bill Taylor just clearly stated that.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. your decision, not ours.
Right.
And the way that Schiff is running these hearings as opposed to earlier hearings, having attorneys ask these questions, you know, that is an important shift. And it does show the seriousness of this and a very conscious effort to kind of take down the circus atmosphere and show that this is a very serious process.
All right. Well, we hope to have you back on and help us walk through this from a South Dakota perspective as we go forward. Have you heard a lot of feedback from students and other faculty members, people in Brookings? How is it sort of playing out in South Dakota?
I think right now there's just quite a bit of interest because now we're actually having public hearings. And I think even just today and tomorrow, especially since I teach on Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, and the hearings were still going on yesterday while my students were in class, I think it will be more of a talking point with the students on Friday, at least for me, mm-hmm. and things like that. But so far, the reactions have really kind of been like, you know, what is kind of the key takeaways? I think some people are kind of wondering what that was, and so that's one of the things that we wanted to specifically highlight, but then also kind of like what's going forward and what does this all mean politically going into the next election.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of the questions we're getting are very mechanical.
Right.
What's the process like?
Yeah, what happens next? What happens
what's the
next?
House
yeah.
role? What's the Senate role? Mm-hmm. And yeah. that sort of thing.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Josh Heyer, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thank you for listening.